We had another chap stay with us, too. I often laugh when I think of him. In fact, I saw some clips of old music hall on telly a couple of years ago, and he was on it. His name was Joe Adami. A-D-A-M-I. And he was called the Human Billiard Table. He used to juggle with billiard cues and billiard balls. And he had like little billiard pockets, like the pockets on the billiard table, stitched onto his suit, onto his shoulders and different parts of his suit. And he used to juggle balls and then he'd catch them, twist himself and catch them in these pockets. But the finale of his act, he had a billiard ball, a billiard cue, and a bowl of live goldfish. A reasonable sized bowl of goldfish this was. But before he done this trick, he used to get some umbrellas and hand them out to the members of the orchestra. And he got the billiard cue, rested it on the ground, stood it up, and he balanced a billiard ball on it, on top of the cue. And then on top of the billiard ball, he put this bowl of goldfish, and he lifted it up and lifted it up, and then he rested it on his chin and balanced it on his chin. Amazing. You wouldn't think it possible, but he could do it. And the drummer and the orchestra gave a long drum roll. Then all of a sudden, this chap, Joe, he used to hit the cue with the side of his hand and knock the cue away. And he used to catch the billiard cue in his left hand, the billiard ball in his right hand, and he used to drop his head down, and he caught the bowl of goldfish on the back of his neck. It sounds impossible, but he done it night after night. Knocked the cue away, caught the cue in his left hand, the ball in his right hand, and as it was coming down, he used to practically kneel down and catch this bowl of goldfish right on the back of his neck. He was a marvellous chap and a wonderful chap to talk to. He was a great comedian. And my brother also, he started taking theatrical people. He took over from my mother. And 1939, the year that war broke out, he had a troupe staying with him. They were a family of musical clowns that were appearing at the Palace Ballroom, Palace Theatre, in 1939. The Dario Barrio family. They were a really wonderful act. They were. I think there were three brothers and two daughters, and the father and mother. And they all played instruments, tapped, danced, juggled, they'd done everything, balanced. But the amazing thing was, all the children were born in different countries. One son was born in Germany, another son was born in Italy. I think the parents were Italian, really. And one of the girls was born in Italy. That's right, one boy was born in Germany, one in Italy, another in France, and the girls, one was born in Switzerland, I think it was, and the other girl in Italy. So then, of course, the war came. So how they went on, we often wondered with them being different nationalities. But I've never seen or heard of any more of them. But it was very entertaining. When the woman, Winnie Collins, and her husband left us the year they left us. I missed that dog they had, Lucky. So only one day, not long after they'd gone, my father came home with a little mongrel puppy and gave it to me. So I christened him Lucky. He was only a mongrel, and he wasn't a very big dog, he was only small. Almost black with a white chest, and he turned out to be really intelligent and marvellous little dog, and it never left my mother. It was always followed my mother from one room to another. And my father used to take it when he went out for a drink about 9 o'clock at night. He used to go down to a public house in St. George's Street called the Forester's Arms. And he used to take the dog with him, Lucky. He used to give him a little sip of beer now and again, and crisps. But he taught him to sit up straight, dead straight, and raise his right paw, right up, on the command of Adolf Hitler. My father used to say, "Heil Hitler!" And Lucky used to sit up there and raise his arm up like a Nazi. Because everyone thought this was marvellous. And when he was only a little puppy, I took him for a walk, and I took him down by the harbour. And I hate saying it, I must have been cruel, but I picked him up and I threw him in the water. He was only about 8 months old, if he was that. But he swam out, he got out, and after that we couldn't keep him out of water. If you walked down the quayside with him, he used to jump off the side when the water was in, and he wouldn't. It was a hell of a job to get him to come out. He loved the water, Lucky. He's a great dog. And over these years, the number of attacks of epilepsy were gradually almost died out. In fact, by the time I was 14, I hadn't had one for about 12 months or more. The last visit I made to the hospital to see Dr. Dorothy Panton, she said that she was almost sure I was cured of them, so there would be no need for me to come again. And I just finished this last bottle of medicine that I was taking. So she said that when the medicine was finished, just carry on and see how things went, but she thought everything would be all right from then on. So my parents were worried about if I went to work, where I would work, and should I go and sit at school for the examinations to go to a secondary school. So apparently Dr. Dorothy advised it would be best not to sit for the exams for a secondary school in case the extra studying and that brought them on again. So it was left like that. And my mother asked her about going for employment, so she said to just keep it quiet and say nothing and see how things went. If anything happened after 14, I would have to, of course, see the doctor again and take it from there. So that's how it went. So I never sat for my secondary school examinations to go to the secondary school. I was very disappointed about that because I was really keen on school. I loved school. I never wanted school to finish. And quite a few of my friends sat for the examination and went on to high school. So it was quite a trying time for me at the time. But as I say, I felt better physically. I was a lot better. I played football. I never went swimming, but I played football, a lot of football, and all the other games at school. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, we didn't play many games at school. We used to have the odd game of cricket in the summertime and played rounders a few times. But football was the sport that I was most interested in. But the time came when I was 14 and time to leave school. As I say, my other friends went on to the high school for further education. So I, along with a lot of the other boys, when we were 14, we left school. Now then, I'm not sure that the post office had got in touch with the schools asking for boys to work as telegraph messengers or not, but the headmaster called me in one day, just before I left the school, Mr. Christian, headmaster at Hanover Street Boys School, and asked me would I like to work in the post office. Of course, he knew nothing about my epilepsy because, as I mentioned earlier, I never had an attack outside the house. So I said I would like it, so he asked me to mention it to my parents and if my father or mother could call in to see him. So I went home, and my mother, as I said before, she never went out. So my father went down to the school and found out all the details, etc. So next thing was I had to go to the post office for an interview, and I went there, and they offered me the post of a boy telegraph messenger. It's a job that's non-existent today. But of course, in those days, very few people had telephones, and the main means of communication was by telegraph. So when I left school on my 14th birthday, I left school on the Friday and reported to the post office the following Monday. And there I commenced work as a boy telegraph messenger. As I just mentioned, people not many people having phones, even all the news for the newspaper, the Isle of Man Times, all came by telegraph. There was a regular trips each day from the office to the Isle of Man Times office with the news, which was sent by telegraph from Liverpool to Douglas and then delivered by boy messenger. And we had regular trips to Athol Street, the main street of Douglas, to lawyers' offices and stockbrokers and all that sort of thing, and all the boarding houses, people booking for holidays or announcing their arrival times. It was quite a busy time for the post office with telegrams in those days. And at Douglas we had 10. There were 10 telegraph boys, and each boy had a number prefixed by two, by T. T2, T4, T5 and such. My number was T2. I used to sing it to myself, T for two. But I really enjoyed it, but I missed school. I did love school, and I wish I could have gone to school for the rest of my life. That's the way I felt about it. I was so happy there, and the teachers were all so good, and the company, all the boys, there were some tough guys. But at that time, to leave school, you were lucky to get work. There was very little employment going. Quite a number of the boys in my class when we left, who didn't go on to secondary school, they joined the forces, which you could do then at the age of 14. The Army and the Air Force and the Navy, I think, was 15. But I knew quite a few. Reggie Clucas, who lived downstairs from us when we lived in the flats in James Street, he went into the Royal Air Force, and Harold Christian, he joined the Royal Horse Artillery. Then there were a few went into the Navy. But as I say, there was a lot of unemployment in those days, at that present time. But they found that the government done their best to find them work. And there was one scheme which I was always thought was a good for the boys who couldn't find work at that time. There was some waste land there up off Summer Hill, which is the far end of the promenade at Douglas, and it came up out by Governor's Bridge, which is on part of the T course. Well, they had these unemployed lads, and they paid them 2 and 6 pence a week. That's 25 pence in modern decimal coin at the present time. And they transformed this waste ground into a beautiful little glen, open to the public, with winding footpaths. There was water running down. They made a little waterfall and a bit of a lake, and put plants in and planted trees. And it's still very popular today. In the summertime, they have lights amongst the trees, coloured lights, you can walk through. It's a beautiful little spot. It's called Summer Hill Glen. And I always remember when it was finished, they put a plaque on Summer Hill as you went in. And on this wooden board was painted, "Let no one say, and say to your shame, that all was beauty here until you came." It always stuck with me, that. I haven't been that way for a few years, so whether it's still there or not, I don't know. But always remember that. "Let no one say, and say it to your shame, that all was beauty here until you came." But that, as I say, that was one scheme where the Douglas Town Corporation employed unemployed youths and give them something to do to keep them up the streets, because, as I said earlier in the tape, there was no unemployment pay in those days. It was a nice little beauty spot, and it's well worth a walk through whenever you're up that way. I often sit in a chair and think back to those times and what people tried to tell me were bad old days. They weren't. And as I said, the Island Man, and Douglas especially, was a beautiful place to live in those days. And like all towns, it had its characters. There were a lot of characters then, which one never seems to hear about characters these days. But then there was one man, he had a wooden leg, like Long John Silver. They called him Peg Leg Cayley. He lived down Big Well Street. He used to be seen hobbling about with one crutch. And then there was another chap, they were called him Scale Lachlan. He was drunk most of the times. They reckoned he used to drink methylated spirits. But it was a shame, because apparently, from what I was told, he'd been a very smart soldier during the First World War, and the cause of his trouble was shell shock. Apparently he'd been a very smart soldier. He'd been there, and he was a sharpshooter, an expert with the rifle, what they used to call them. You never heard of them in the Second World War much, but in the First World War you heard of them a lot, called snipers, who were placed in strategic places, up in trees and places, to try and stop anyone getting in to your lines. So I often felt sorry for old Skay. He used to be found drunk, and they'd pick him. The police would pick him up and put him in the police station, and he'd have a week or a few days there. He'd sober up, and then they'd let him out again. I don't think he had anywhere to live. I never heard of him having a home. I'm sure he was just like a destitute person. Then there was a little chap here. He was a bit of a dwarf. I don't know what his second name was, but everyone called him Leslie. And in the summer season, he used to be outside the Villa Marina with a big basket with little with flowers in, made up beautiful, you know, for men to put in their buttonhole in their collars of their jackets going to the dance, and little bouquets to posies, they called them in those days, for chaps to buy for their girlfriends. He was very well known for years and years. And then there was a little tiny man who had a newspaper shop on the quay, on the quayside at Douglas. And I think his name was Quine, Mr. Quine, but the young children, we always called him Johnny Puttynose. And in those days, there was a daily newspaper, the Island Man Daily Times. It was only a couple of sheets. I think it was a penny. Give the main English news on the front and what local news there was. There was also a weekly Isle of Man Times, but this was the daily. He used to stand at the corner of Duke Street and Victoria Street, and had the papers under his arm, and he used to sell them there. And he'd done quite a lot of trade, everyone knew him. The kiddies used to call him Johnny Puttynose, and he'd put his fingers up to his nose and shout after you. But one time, one year in the 1930s, it must have been the early 30s, I think, there was quite a big ship, a liner anchored in Douglas Bay. For a number of years around that time, exiled Manx people in Canada and America, they used to hire a ship and come for a homecoming visit. They used to call them the homecomers. 2 or 3 years, I remember that happening. Anyway, this big boat was in the bay, and Johnny Puttynose was on the corner, his little regular corner, shouting, "Big boat in the bay! Big boat in the bay!" That was the news headline. But for years after, he'd be standing on the corner still shouting, "Big boat in the bay! Big boat in the bay!" Oh, it must have been 6 or 7 years after Johnny Puttynose was still shouting, "Big boat in the bay." And then there were two little, rather small chaps. They used to be down on the promenade there, where people could hire rowing boats to go in the bay. And these two chaps, they used to be there. And their nickname was High Bell and Low Kelly. I don't know what their first names were, but everyone knew them as High and Low. High Bell and Low Kelly. And they used to, at the end of the day, they used to dress to kill. And they used to wear striped suits, navy blue stripe with a stripe in tight at the waist and big padded shoulders, like the gangsters on the cinema screens. Jimmy Cagney and those gangster films, they used to dress like that, with trilby hats on. They were two real characters, everyone knew them. Real happy blokes. And then there were two girls of dubious character. Everyone knew them. Baldrine Betty and the Peel Vamp. They used to strut about Strand Street. They were older than what I was. I knew them by reputation more than by visually seeing them. And then in those days, a little street, Walpole Avenue, there was a cinema. The building is actually still there today. The Royalty Cinema, from Lord Street through to the promenade. And along there used to be two herbal shops. The one on one side was Moore's Herbier Shop. And on the other side was another one, Blackburn's Herb Shop. Oh, they were very well patronised. And they used to open in the winter time. Lots of people used to go in there. It was a nice day in the winter, have a walk along the promenade. and then go to a Moore's Hair Beer Shop, and you can have a Hot Horlicks or Hot Ovaltine or Herb Beer and Sarsaparilla. A very popular drink was half and half, half Herb Beer and half Sarsaparilla. And they're all, every herb you could think of, and medicines on the shelves or in the back of the counter. And they had herbs from the garden in bunches hanging from the ceiling. There was a lovely smell there and a beautiful atmosphere. And they had ice cream too, of course. They were well patronised in the summer, but in the winter too on a Sunday afternoon. But a couple of my friends and I, we used to go to Blackburn's. And this chap behind, whether he was the son, he used to serve behind the counter there, Benny Blackburn. He had quite a big head and a shock of black hair, beautiful black hair. But he was absolutely crazy about football. And the youngsters used to get in, two young 12, 13, 14-year-old kiddies. And he loved telling them about football and telling them that he'd been away and had a trial with Everton football team. Whether he did or not, I don't know. But his main phrase was, I was there nodding them in, and he used to shake his head as if he was nodding the ball into the back of a net. Dancing about behind the counter there telling these stories. Oh, he was quite a character, was Benny. And then there was old Valerio. He was an Italian. He had a little square organ on a stick. He used to go around in the summertime playing this organ. He used to stop and had a strap over his shoulder. And he used to carry this organ, and then he'd get to a pitch and he'd stand it on this one leg and turn the handle and play the tunes. And he, a very dark-skinned man, greyish hair, always a big smile on his face. And then there was another organ which was like about the size of a piano on a little cart pulled by a pony. And there were two brothers used to play this, the Collister brothers. One used to wind the handle and play the tunes, and the other brother used to go around door to door collecting. And then when they'd finished, the one would sit at the front, and at the back of the truck the other one used to stand. There were two little steps, and he used to stand on that and hold tight onto this piano shaped organ, and they'd moved off to the next place. Then there was Harry Winter. He had a little cart, a fruit cart, and he had it pulled by a donkey. And this donkey, he had a straw hat on the donkey with its ears coming through the straw hat. He used to go round house to house selling fruit. He was very popular. He was a Lancashire man, but he liked his pint of beer, Harry Winter. And he used to go to the pubs. One pub he used to go to quite a lot was the one my father went to in Church Street. I just forget the name. Forget the name of it now, something Arms. But he used to go there and he'd go in and he'd come out with a pint of beer for the donkey. Everyone knew Harry Winter and his donkey. When you think of all the hills in Douglas, that poor donkey had to pull the cart laden with fruit and veg. It was amazing how they could do it. And then round our houses there was a man named Winkle. I'm sure he was German, whether his father had been a prisoner of war in the First World War or not, I don't know, or whether he had been. But he used to come round and shout, cakes, and he had beautiful cakes, beautiful pastries. He came from a place called Foxdale on the island. I know my mother used to love his cakes, his pastries. So, one never hears or sees characters like this today. And at the top of Victoria Street, outside the Rosebery buildings, actually, they've just pulled the buildings down. the moment there, pulling them down. Well, it was facing down, it faced down Duke Street. There was a little radio shop on the one corner, and then there was an entrance into office accommodation up above, and there used to be a barber's in there, a chap named Kelly in that doorway. And then there was a little tobacconist shop, Jim Cooley's the tobacconist, and then there was a little fruit shop, and then a newsagent's on the corner. Well, just outside these shops, especially on a Saturday night, there used to be quite a gathering of about half a dozen, eight men. And they used to call it the House of Keys, because they used to be there saying what should be done and what shouldn't be done. I've stopped there quite a few times, because one of the lads I went to school with, Harry Collister his name was, he had a cousin. And I'm not sure whether the cousin's name was Collister or not, but I only ever knew him by the name of Cudge, whether it was C-U-J-J or C-U-D-G-E, I don't know, but it was pronounced Cudge. And he was maybe 3 or 4 years older than me. And he was quite a small chap, but he always had a big grin on his face. And he wouldn't have been out of place on the Derby Castle Music Hall Theatre. He used to come out with some wonderful expressions and jokes. Non-stop. I remember at the time, about 1936, I think, there was a murder committed, and that was a very rare thing in the Isle of Man. In fact, that was the only murder that I ever knew that took place here in my lifetime. It was a man named Kissick. He was a mental patient who'd got out, and he went up in Douglas Head, and not sure he killed a man and a woman or one of them. But anyway, he got off, and there was the police were out searching for him. And this was the discussion at this House of Keys outside the Rosebery Buildings. And at that time, there was a policeman on the force at Douglas named Charlie Crowe. He was a real old Manx type. I think I mentioned earlier about him moving a pony from one street to another because he couldn't spell the name of the street. But everyone knew him, Charlie Crowe. He was a great big, like a caricature of a policeman, big fat bloke with a big moustache. Anyway, these lads were all on about this murder. And Cudge said, oh yes, he said, they're out searching, he said. And Charlie Crowe's up on the mountain. He's disguised as a rabbit. Oh, it was funny, everybody burst out laughing at the thought of Charlie Crowe, the policeman, disguised as a rabbit. Anyway, they caught this murderer up on the mountain. And I remember when the weekly paper came up, the headline was, in big letters, Hands Up Kissick. So, they were happy that people saying that there were bad times. And that's how most of life was. If you went for a walk through Strand Street in the winter time, people might think that would have been a holiday resort. When the winter came, and the summer season finished, and the winter came, everything would be dead here. But it wasn't. There was dancing at the Palais de Dance. The Villa Marina used to have dances on Thursday and on Saturday. Quite a few of the church halls had dances. And there were whist drives. The Royalty Cinema was open, the Regal Cinema was open, the Picture House and the Strand Cinema in Strand Street were open, and at the Gaiety Theatre, the Amateur Dramatic and Operatic Societies put on shows, so life wasn't dull in the winter time, and sometimes you used to find it harder to walk through Strand Street, the main street of course. in the winter time than it was in the summer, because everyone you met was shouting, "Hello, have you got a minute?" And they'd stop and talk to you. And you'd perhaps be an audience. You couldn't get through the street without stopping to talk to people. And people popped there to the shop who you knew. "Hiya, you know, and have you seen so-and-so?" You had more conversation in the winter time walking through the street than what you ever did in the summertime, because there were so many tourists, or visitors as we call them then, that the locals were lost for a bit in the summertime. Oh no, it was a great place. Happy days. Anyway, as I say, I started work as a boy telegraph messenger. I got my uniform, and incidentally, they were the first long trousers I ever wore. Most of them, all the boys at that time, you wore short trousers and all the time through school until you started work. So I got my first long trousers. The uniform was navy blue serge. And it was serge. It was thick and coarse. But it was a navy blue jacket with brass buttons right up to the neck, up to the collar, right up to the neck. There was no shirt showing. And the trousers were the same material with a pipe red stripe down the side. And you wore a little pillbox hat with a peak on it. Something like the type of hat that the old Foreign Legion used to wear in the days of Beau Geste. And that was lined with a thin red piping round, a little button on top. Then you had a leather belt with a brass buckle and a pouch for carrying the telegrams in. And we used to ride red bikes painted, post office bikes painted red. And they were real heavy bikes. They're not like push bikes today. They were real heavy, strong frames. And when I started, at night time, they only had oil lamps. You had to fill them with oil and trim the wick. You had to clean your bike when you came on duty. You had to clean your bike. The first thing you had to do was go before the inspector, who checked your uniform and made sure your boots were polished and the buckles on your belt, and that you were smart. Well, then you got your bike sorted out and cleaned up. Now, the post office, the main post office, was where it still is, in Regent Street. But it was different altogether to what the post office is like today. And we were in quite a big square room with a bench on one side, the bikes in racks on the floor there, and there were quite a few bikes, spare bikes, hanging on pulleys from the ceiling. In the corner on the right-hand side was a little desk, and the side of this desk was a cage and a tube running up to the ceiling, and that tube went right up through the ceiling to the room above where the machines were that received the telegrams. They were called teleprinters. They were massive, big machines and a keyboard like a typewriter. And when the message came through from the person in Liverpool, it used to come out in a white long strip at the side of the machine. So the operator would then tear the strips up and put them onto a pinkish form, put them in an envelope and addressed them, and put them in a little round container and put them into a cage, or lift a little flap, and put them into this tube. They dropped down to the ground floor, and the inspector of boy messengers, he used to take it out of the cage, and when he'd got a few there, he'd call the boy whose next turn was to go out and give him the messages to deliver. So you put them in your pouch and you got your bike, took it out and set off delivering these telegrams. Oh, it was quite a nice job. I really enjoyed it. Before I left school, I used to do work riding a push bike with a carrier at the front for a fruiterer in Nelson Street, a shop called Ford's Fruit Shop. I used to go from school, 4 o'clock as soon as I left school, to this shop, and I worked there, and in winter time it would be 7 or 8 before I was finished, and I worked all day Saturday from 8 in the morning till about 7 on the Saturday night for 2 and 6 pence a week. But in the summertime it got hectic there, and they were keeping me there till 10 o'clock working, till my father, no extra money, it's still only the 2 and 6 pence. My father said, oh, that just happened slave labour there, so he made me stop that. But as a telegraph messenger, I started at 7 shillings and 6 pence a week. That's in the old currency. And as I say, there were 10 boy messengers. Just trying to think who they were. There was myself, a chap called Bill Kelly, Billy Cashin, Jack Connor, George Christian, Tinny Clucas, Frank Ward, Alec Harrison, Gus Carson, and George Johnson. They were the 10. Now then, the post office at that time belonged to the English government. A few years after the Second World War, the Isle of Man government took the post office system over from the English government and run their own post office, which it is today. It's now the Manx post office, but in those days it was the English government. And you started work at 14 as a boy messenger, and you attended night school, evening classes in the winter, for 2 years. Then you sat for an examination, the civil service examination. If you passed that, you became a sorting, counter and telegraphist clerk, a clerical officer. If you failed the exam, you carried on till you were 18 and then became a postman. That was the system. But being a boy messenger, you used to be going round on your bike and whistling away there. Well, as I said, there were quite a few characters about with these boy messengers too. This lad I just mentioned, Frank Carson. When we went to the night school for the first year, he started the same time as me, and was like Bill Kelly, he started the same time as me. We went to the first class of evening classes, and the teacher asked, we'll start the register, asking our names. And when he came to Frank Carson, he said, yes, what's your name? He said, Francis Colburn Goldsmith Carson. The teacher, I always remember his name is Mr. Carroll. He said, I asked for your name, not the family motto. Yes, that was a mouthful, wasn't it? Francis Colburn Goldsmith Carson. But it was a bit, thinking back, it was a bit naughty in a way. We had to go to evening classes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So we worked the early shifts, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday. Then Thursday, Friday and Saturday, we had to work the late shifts. So for the 2 years, that you were attending night school in the winter months, you never got a night off, only Sunday. You were at evening classes, night school, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and you were on the late shift Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Because the lads who'd failed as the civil service examination and were over 16, they worked the late shifts Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday to let the younger ones go to the night school, you see. So they had the early shift Thursday, Friday and Saturday. But we used to have to go some long distances too. And when you went on a long distance at night, you had to use, I've never seen them for years, a lamp called carbide. They were bigger than the oil lamps. They were a damn nuisance, the oil lamps, because the heavy wind that blew the lights out. But these carbide lamps, they had a container underneath the actual light part, and this stuff called carbide, I think it was called, you had to put some of this in this container, and then there was a bit of water, and that made, when the reaction of the water on this carbide was like a gas, and it made quite a bright light. It was a good light, and the wind didn't blow it out. And then we used to get telegrams now and again for a farm at a little place called Port Sodrick, which is 4 or 5 miles, I would say, from Douglas. And you had to ride out there and down onto the beach. I remember I got one night. You worked until 9 o'clock, was the latest. And I got this message to go to this farm about 8 o'clock on a Friday night, and it was pouring rain, the wind was blowing a gale, you had waterproof leggings and a cape, which you, a round cape like a bell tent, and it had two bits of elastic stitched inside, which you put your hands in to hold onto the handlebars. But when the wind got blowing, it blew underneath this cape, you nearly took off.